This is text for making audiobook in format MP3 of 7 Years in Tibet, of Heinrich Harrer. Note that this is written by the person that Rampu also mentioned in one of his books. He, Heinrich Harrer, was in Tibet at the same time as Lobsang Rangpa, that is, before Rampu took on the task of taking over the English body in 1949. Which enabled him to come to the West to write these books on Tibet's life and spiritual insights. As Rampa writes, his success with the book, The Third Eye, made Harrer jealous of his success and insights, and he then did everything in his power to try to blacken Rangpa. Just as Harrer himself would have the honor of bringing a glimpse into the hidden mystery of Tibet, to the West in the post-war years. Rune's introductory remark. Translated from the German by Richard Graves. Copyright 1953 by Heinrich Harrer. Web book found online. You may even want to format this text to be more readable via, for example, the program OpenOffice or similar. Introduction. It was a thick veil, and it did not get much thinner as the years went by. The end of the 19th century found Europe's eyes turning toward Asia. The geographical challenge of Africa had been, in its essentials, met, and on that continent the political problems, save in South Africa, appeared in those days to be soluble only in the chanceries of European capitals. In Asia, by contrast, imponderable and exotic forces were on the move. Russia's conquests in Central Asia had fulfilled what was believed to be only the first phase of her territorial ambitions. In the minds of Lord Curzon and of Kipling, her attempts to probe with reconnaissance parties the mountain barrier that separated her armies from India produced apprehensions that the event proved to be disproportionate. But here again Asia came into the picture, for while Young Aspand, bringing artillery into action, for the first and so far the last time in history, at 17,000 feet above sea level, was defeating the Tibetans, the Japanese, with much less of apology in their manner, were defeating the Russians in Manchuria. And only 3 years earlier, in the Boxer Rebellion, an international expedition had raised the siege of the legation quarter in Peking. Tibet did no more then than she had before, or has since, to gratify Europe's curiosities about Asia, she continued, increasingly, to stimulate them. The extent to which she reciprocated them was inimical. Once for Tibetan boys, in the pages that follow, you will meet briefly the only survivor of a sensible experiment that the Tibetans never got around to repeating, were sent to be educated at Rugby, and until the Chinese Communist forces took the country over, in 1950, the sons of noblemen quite often went to school in India, learning among other things, the English language. Europe would have welcomed Tibetans gladly. As she has welcomed travelers and students from every other Asiatic country, but whereas, broadly speaking, Europe wants like anything to go to Tibet, Tibet has never evinced the slightest desire to go to Europe. She has, moreover, made it as difficult as possible for Europeans, or indeed for any non-Tibetans, to set foot on Tibetan territory, however impeccable their credentials. The veil of secrecy, or perhaps rather of exclusiveness, which was lifted by Young Aspand and then so tantalizingly dropped again, has in the last 50 years been effectively penetrated by very few, and of these it is safe to say that not one attained to the remarkable position that the author of this book, toward the end of his 5 years' residence in Lhasa, found himself occupying in the entourage of the young Dalai Lama. The European traveler is accustomed to seeing Asia, or anyhow the backwoods of Asia, from above. By that I mean that, although at times his situation may be precarious and his resources slender, the European is generally a good deal better off than the primitive people through whose territory he is passing. He possesses things that they do not: money and firearms, soap and medicines, tents and can openers. He has, moreover, in another part of the planet a government that, should he get into trouble, will try to get him out of it. So the foreigner tends to ride upon the high though not very reliable horse of privilege, and to view the backwoods and their denizens from above. It was otherwise with Herr Harrer. when, in 1943, he made a third and successful attempt to escape from an internment camp at Dehradun and headed for Tibet, he was seeing Asia from below. He traveled on foot, carried his few possessions on his back, and slept on the ground in the open. He was a fugitive, with no status, no papers, and very limited funds. For a well-found expedition to follow his circuitous winter route across the Chenghang Plateau and down to Lhasa would have been a creditable feat, as performed by Hara and his companion, Orf Snater, the journey was an astonishing tour de force. When they reached Lhasa, they were penniless and in rags. Though there was no shred of justification for their presence in the Tibetan capital, they met with great kindness there, and the various subterfuges that they had practiced upon officials along the route aroused merriment rather than indignation. They had, nevertheless, every reason to expect to be expelled from the country, and although the war was now over, Hara assumed, on rather slender grounds, that expulsion would mean their re-internment in India. He spoke by now fairly fluent Tibetan, though with a country accent that amused the sophisticates of Lhasa, and he never ceased to entreat permission to stay where he was and to do useful work for the government. I have not met Herr Hara, but from the pages that follow, he emerges as a sensible, unassuming, and very brave man, with simple tastes and solid standards. It is clear that from the first the Tibetans liked him, and it must, I think, have been his integrity of character that led the authorities to connive at, if never formally to authorize, his 5 years' sojourn in Lhasa. During this period he rose, always, it would seem, because of the confidence he inspired rather than because he angled for preferment, from being a destitute and alien vagabond to a well-rewarded post as tutor and confidant of the young Dalai Lama. Of this 14-year-old potentate, Hara, who was certainly closer to him than any foreigner, with the possible exception of Sir Charles Bell, has been to any of his predecessors, gives a fascinating and sympathetic account. When the Chinese communists invaded Tibet, in 1950, Hara's parting from this lonely, able, and affectionate youth was clearly a wrench to both of them. It is unlikely that their conquerors will be able to alter the Tibetan character, so curiously compounded of mysticism and jollity, of shrewdness and superstition, of tolerance and strict convention, but the ancient, ramshackle structure of Tibetan society, over which the Dalai Lama in his successive incarnations presides, is full of flaws and anachronisms, and will scarcely survive in its traditional form the ideological stresses to which it is now being subjected. It is the luckiest of chances that Herr Hara should have had, and should have made such admirable use of, the opportunity to study on intimate terms a people with whom the West is now denied even the vestigial contacts that it had before. The story of what he did and what he saw equals in strangeness Mr. Heyerdahl's account of his voyage on the Kon-Tiki, and it is told, I am happy to say, in the same sort of simple, unpretentious style. Peter Fleming. Preface. All our dreams begin in youth. As a child I found the achievements of the heroes of our day far more inspiring than book learning. The men who went out to explore new lands, on with toil and self-sacrifice fitted themselves to become champions in the field of sport, the conquerors of the great peaks. To imitate such men was the goal of my ambition. But I lacked the advice and guidance of experienced counselors and so wasted many years before I realized that one must not pursue several aims at the same time. I had tried my hand at various forms of sport without achieving the success that might have satisfied me. So at last I determined to concentrate on the two that I had always loved for their close association with nature, skiing and mountain climbing. I had spent most of my childhood in the Alps and had occupied most of my time out of school climbing in summer and ski running in winter. My ambition was spurred on by small successes, and in 1936, I succeeded after severe training in gaining a place on the Austrian Olympic team. A year later, I was the winner of the downhill race in the World Students' Championships. In these contests, I experienced the joy of speed and the glorious satisfaction of a victory into which one has put all that one has. But victory over human rivals and the public recognition of success did not satisfy me. I began to feel that the only worthwhile ambition was to measure my strength against the mountains. So for whole months together, I practiced on rock and ice, until I became so fit that no precipice seemed to me unconquerable. But I had my troubles to contend with and had to pay for my experience. Once I fell 170 feet, and it was only by a miracle that I did not lose my life, and, of course, lesser mishaps were constantly occurring. Return to life at the university always meant a big wrench. But I ought not to complain. I had opportunities for studying all sorts of works on mountaineering and travel, and as I devoured these books they grew in my mind, out of a complex of vague desires. The ambition to realize the dream of all climbers, to take part in an expedition in the Himalayas. But how dared an unknown youngster like myself toy with such ambitious dreams? Why, to get to the Himalayas one had either to be very rich or to belong to the nation whose sons at that time still had the chance of being sent to India on service. For a man who was neither British nor wealthy, there was only one way. One had to make use of one of those rare opportunities open even to outsiders and do something that made it impossible for one's claims to be passed over. But what performance would put one in this class? Every alpine peak has long been climbed, even the worst ridges and rock faces have yielded to the incredible skill and daring of mountaineers. But stay. There was still one unconquered precipice, the highest and most dangerous of all, the north wall of the Eiger. This 6,700 feet of sheer rock face had never been climbed to the top. All attempts had failed, and many men had lost their lives in the attempt. A cluster of legends had gathered round this monstrous mountain wall, and at last the Swiss government had forbidden alpinists to climb on it. No doubt that was the adventure I was looking for. If I broke through the virgin defences of the north wall, I would have a legitimate right, as it were, to be selected for an expedition to the Himalayas. I brooded long over the idea of attempting this almost helpless feat. How, in 1938, I succeeded with my friends Fritz Gaspar, and Earl Heckmeyer, and Wiggerl Vorg in climbing the dreaded wall has been described in several books. After this adventure, I spent the autumn in continuing my training with the hope always in mind that I would be invited to join in the Nanga Parbat expedition planned for the summer of 1939. It seemed as though I would have to go on hoping, for winter came and nothing happened. Others were selected to reconnoitre the fateful mountain in Kashmir. And so nothing was left for me but to sign, with a heavy heart, a contract to take part in a ski film. Rehearsals were well advanced when I was suddenly called to the telephone. It was the long-desired summons to take part in the Himalaya expedition, which was starting in 4 days. I had no need to reflect. I broke my contract without an instant's hesitation. Traveled home to Graz, spent a day in packing my things, and on the following day was en route for Antwerp with Peter Aufschneider, the leader of the German Nanga Parbat expedition, Lutz Chicken, and Hans Lobenhofer, the other members of the group. Up to that time there had been 4 attempts to climb this 25,000-foot mountain. All had failed. They had cost many lives, and so it had been decided to look for a new way up. That was to be our job, and the attack on the peak was planned for the following year. On this expedition to Nanga Parbat I succumbed to the magic of the Himalayas. The beauty of these gigantic mountains, the immensity of the lands on which they look down, the strangeness of the people of India, all these worked on my mind like a spell. Since then, many years have passed, but I have never been able to cut loose from Asia. How all this came about, and what it led to, I shall try to describe in this book, and as I have no experience as an author, I shall content myself with the unadorned facts. Internment. By the end of August 1939, we had completed our reconnaissance. We had actually found a new way up the mountain and were now waiting in Karachi for the freighter that was to take us back to Europe. Our ship was long overdue, and the war clouds were growing even denser. Chicken, Lobenhofer, and I accordingly made up our minds to extricate ourselves from the net that the secret police had already begun to lay for us and to slip away, wherever we found an opening. Only Aufsnater was for staying in Karachi. He had fought in the First World War and could not believe in a second. The rest of us planned to break through to Persia and find our way home from there. We had no difficulty in shaking off the man who was shadowing us, and after crossing a few hundred miles of desert in our ramshackle car, we managed to reach La Spila, a little principality to the northwest of Karachi. But the fate overtook us, and we suddenly found ourselves taken in charge by 8 soldiers, on the grounds that we needed personal protection. We were, in fact, under arrest, although Germany and the British Commonwealth were not yet at war. Soon we were back with our trusty escort in Karachi, where we found Peter Aufsnater. 2 days later, England did declare war on Germany. After that, everything went like clockwork. A few minutes after the declaration of war, 25 Indian soldiers armed to the teeth marched into a restaurant garden where we were sitting, to fetch us away. We drove in a police car to an already prepared prison camp fenced with barbed wire. But that turned out to be merely a transit camp, and a fortnight later we were transferred to the great internment camp 8 Armed Nagar, near Bombay. There we were quartered in crowded tents and huts in the midst of a babel of conflicting opinions and excited talk. No, I thought, this atmosphere is too different from the sunlit, lonely heights of the Himalayas. This is no life for freedom-loving men. So I began to get busy looking for ways and means of escape. Of course, I was not the only one planning to get away. With the help of like-minded companions, I collected compasses, money, and maps, which had been smuggled past the controls. We even managed to get hold of leather gloves and a barbed wire cutter, the loss of which from the stores provoked a strict but fruitless investigation. As we all believed that the war would soon be over, we kept postponing our plans for escape. But one day we were suddenly moved to another camp. We were loaded onto a convoy of trucks en route for Dioli. 18 of us internees sat in each truck with a single Indian soldier to guard us. The sentry's rifle was made fast to his belt with a chain so that no one could snatch it away. At the head and at the tail of the column was a truck full of soldiers. While we were in the camp at Armed Nagar, Loeb and Hofor and I had determined to make a getaway before being transferred to a new camp, where fresh difficulties might endanger our chances of escape. So now we took our seats at the back end of a truck. Luckily for us, the road was full of curves and we were often enveloped in thick clouds of dust. We saw that this gave us a chance of jumping off unnoticed and vanishing into the jungle. We did not expect the guard in the truck to spot us as he was obviously occupied in watching the truck in front. He only occasionally looked around at us. One way and another, it did not seem to us that it would be too difficult to escape, and we postponed an attempt until the latest possible moment, intending to get across into a neutral Portuguese enclave situated very near the route of our convoy. At last the moment came, we jumped off, and I ran 20 yards off the road and threw myself down in a little hollow behind a bush. Then to my horror, the whole convoy stopped. I heard whistles and shooting and then, seeing the guard running over to the far side of the road, I had no doubt what had happened. Loeb and Hofer must have been discovered, and as he was carrying our rucksack with all our gear, there was nothing for me to do but to give up my hopes of escape as well. Fortunately, I succeeded, in the confusion, in getting back into my seat without being noticed by any of the soldiers. Only my comrades knew that I had got away, and, naturally, they said nothing. Then I saw Obenhofer. He was standing with his hands up, facing a line of bayonets. I felt broken with the deadly disappointment of our failure. But my friend was really not to blame for it. He was carrying our heavy rucksack in his hand when he jumped off, and it seems that it made a clatter, which was heard by the guard, so he was caught before he could gain the shelter of the jungle. We learned from this adventure a bitter but useful lesson, namely that in any combined plan of escape, each of the escapers must carry all that he needed with him. In the same year, we were moved once more to another camp. This time we were conveyed by rail to the greatest POW camp in India, a few miles outside the town of Dehradun. Above Dehradun was the hill station of Mussoorie, the summer residence of the British and rich Indians. Our camp consisted of 7 great sections, each surrounded by a double fence of barbed wire. The whole camp was enclosed by 2 more lines of wire entanglement, between which patrols were constantly on the move. The conditions of our new camp altered the whole situation for us. As long as we were down below in the plain, we always aimed to escape into one of the neutral Portuguese territories. Up here, we had the Himalayas right in front of us. How attractive to a mountaineer was the thought of winning through to Tibet over the passes. As a final goal, one thought of the Japanese lines in Burma or China. Plans for escape in these conditions and with these objectives needed the most careful preparation. By now we had given up hope of a speedy ending to the war, and so there was nothing for it, if we wished to get away, but to organize systematically. Flight through the thickly populated regions of India was out of the question, for that one would need plenty of money and a perfect knowledge of English, and I had neither. So it is easy to imagine that my preference was for the empty spaces of Tibet. And I thought of being on the Himalayas, and felt that even if my plan failed, it would be worth having a spell of freedom in the high mountains. I now set to work to learn a little Hindustani, Tibetan, and Japanese, and devoured all sorts of travel books on Asia, which I found in the library, especially those dealing with the districts on my prospective route. I made extracts from these works and took copies of the most important maps. Peter Orff Snater, who had also landed in Dehradun, had various books and maps dealing with expeditions in Asia. He worked at these with tireless energy, and put all his notes and sketches at my disposal. I copied all of these in duplicate, keeping one copy to take with me when I escaped and the other as a reserve in case the originals were lost. It was just as important for me, in view of the route by which I proposed to escape, to keep myself physically as fit as possible. So every day I devoted hours to exercising in the open air, indifferent to bad and good weather alike, while at night I used to lie out and study the habits of the guards. My chief worry was that I had too little money, for although I had sold everything I could do without, my savings were quite insufficient to provide for the necessaries of life in Tibet, let alone for the bribes and presents which are the commonplaces of life in Asia. Nevertheless, I went on working systematically at my plan and received help from some friends, who themselves had no intention of escaping. I had originally intended to escape alone in order not to have to consider a companion, which might have prejudiced my chances. But one day my friend Rolf Magina told me that an Italian general had the same intentions as myself. I had previously heard of this man, and so one night Magina and I climbed through the wire fence into the neighboring wing, in which 40 Italian generals were housed. My future companion was named Marchese and was in outward appearance a typical Italian. He was something over 40 years of age, slim of figure, with agreeable manners, and distinctly well dressed. I was particularly impressed by his physique. At the outset we had difficulties in understanding one another. He spoke no German, and I no Italian. We both knew only a minimum of English, so we conversed, with the help of a friend, in halting French. Marchese told me about the war in Abyssinia, and of an earlier attempt he had made to escape from a POW camp. Fortunately for him, he received the pay of an English general, and money was no problem. He was able to procure for our flight things that I could never have obtained. What he needed was a partner familiar with the Himalayas, so we very soon joined forces on the basis that I should be responsible for all the planning, and he for the money and equipment. Several times every week I used to crawl out to discuss details with Marchese, and by practice became an expert in penetrating barbed wire. Of course there were various possibilities for the escape, but the one that seemed to me the most promising was based on one important fact, that every 80 yards along the outer fence enclosing the whole camp was a steep, straw-thatched roof that had been put up to protect the sentries against the tropical sun. If we could climb over one of these roofs, we should have crossed the 2 lines of barbed wire at a single bound. In May 1943, we had completed our preparations. Money, provisions, compass, watches, shoes, and a small mountaineer's tent were all ready. One night we decided to make the attempt. I climbed as usual through the fence into Marchese's wing. There I found a ladder ready, which we had grabbed and hidden after a small fire in the camp. We leaned it against the wall of a hut and waited in the shadow. It was nearly midnight, and in 10 minutes the guard would change. The sentries, waiting to come off duty, walked slackly up and down. A few minutes passed until they reached the point where we wanted them. Just then the moon came up over the tops of the tea plantation. It was now or never. Both the sentries had reached their farthest point from us. I got up from my crouching position and hurried to the fence with the ladder. I laid it against the overhanging top of the fence, climbed up, and cut the wires, which had been bunched together to prevent access to the thatch. Marchese pushed the thicket of wires to one side with their long, forked stick, enabling me to slip through onto the roof. It was agreed that the Italian should follow me immediately, while I held the wire apart with my hands, but he did not come. He lingered for a few ghastly seconds, thinking that it was too late and that the guards were already returning, and, indeed, I heard their steps. I left him no time for further reflection but caught him under the arms and pulled him onto the roof. He crept across and dropped heavily down into freedom. But all this had not happened in dead silence. The watch was alarmed, and they started shooting, but as their firing broke the stillness of the night, we were swallowed up by the jungle. The first thing that Marchese did, in expression of his warm southern temperament, was to embrace and kiss me, though this was hardly the moment to give vent to outbursts of joy. Rockets went up and whistles sounded near us, showing that pursuers were on our track. We ran for our lives and moved very fast, using shortcuts which I had got to know very well during my outings from the camp. We made little use of the roads and skirted around the few villages we found on our way. At the outset we hardly noticed our packs, but later on they began to feel heavy. In one of the villages, the natives beat their drums, and we at once fancied they were sounding the alarm. That was one of the difficulties that anyone brought up among our exclusively white population can hardly imagine. In Asia, the Sahib invariably travels with an escort of servants and never carries the smallest package himself. What would the natives think, therefore, when they saw two heavily laden Europeans plodding on foot through the countryside? We decided to march by night, knowing that the Indians are afraid to go through the jungle in darkness on account of the wild beasts. We did not enjoy the prospect particularly ourselves, having often read stories in the newspapers available in the camp of man-eating tigers and leopards. When day dawned we hid ourselves, exhausted, in a wadi, and spent the whole day there, sleeping and eating in the burning heat. We saw only one person during the day, a cowherd. Fortunately, he did not see us. The worst thing was that we each of us had only a single water bottle, which had to suffice for the whole day. It was no wonder that when evening came, after a day spent in keeping quiet, we could hardly control our nerves. We wanted to get on as quickly as possible, and the nights seemed far too short for our progress. We had to find the shortest way through the Himalayas to Tibet, and that would mean weeks of strenuous marching before we could feel ourselves in safety. We crossed the first ridge on the evening after our escape. At the top, we rested for a while and saw 3,000 feet below us the countless twinkling lights of the internment camp. At 11 o'clock, the lights all went out together, and only the searchlights around the camp gave an idea of its enormous extent. This was the first time in my life that I really understood what it meant to be free. We enjoyed this glorious feeling and thought with sympathy of the 2,000 POWs forced to live down there behind the wall of wire. But we had not much time for meditation. We had to find our way down to the valley of the Jumma, which was completely unknown to us. In one of the smaller valleys, we walked into a cleft so narrow that we could not get on, and had to wait till morning. The place was so lonely and sheltered that I could without misgiving take the opportunity to dye my blonde hair and beard black. I also stained my face and hands with a mixture of permanganate, brown paint, and grease, which produced a dark shade. By this means, I acquired some resemblance to an Indian. That was important, as we had decided, if we were challenged, to say that we were on a pilgrimage to the sacred Ganges. As for my companion, he was dark enough not to be noticeable at a distance.